Today I'm at 11 King's Bench Walk talking with Sean Jones QC about the employment implications of social media, and we're then going to look at the lie of the land in terms of practice at the bar. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me over. Social media causes particular problems. We know that there are issues on Twitter at the moment in relation to libel. We know that many have effectively committed acts of contempt of court, that the Attorney General is getting concerned about it, and regulation may well, and prosecution may well follow in terms of contempt of court. But there are particular difficulties in terms of employment law with social media, and it's quite common these days, is it not, for employers to have a quick look at what you're tweeting and what you're putting up on your Facebook page. Perhaps you could draw on your experience as an expert in this field.
Well, there are really two problems. One is a broader social problem, the social media and employment. The other is a more specific problem about how one hammers the new experience of employees engaging with the world generally on social media into the existing framework of employment rights. And dealing with the larger issue first, so far as the social problem is concerned, quite a lot of our law, and essentially the whole of our employment law, is premised on a distinction between a private life and a work life. And the understanding has been that your private life is absolutely none of your employer's business, save in exceptional circumstances, and your work life is where you're required to behave and where your conduct is assessed. The problem with social media is it creates a merger between those two worlds. Possibly you might want to think of it as being a third world entirely, a sort of public-private life. So for me, the best way to think about it is your first week at university, where you wander around pretending to be the person you had always intended to be, with your parents not being around. Now you're a poet and a great philosopher, and you have deep political insights, with which you bore your new friends and companions, until everyone realises that that's not really you, and you are in fact from Essex, and you went to grammar school, and you're no great genius. And then the true you eventually emerges. Well, social media and Twitter in particular, it's like the whole world is now doing that. Everyone is holding themselves out as being an expert in things they know relatively little about, and everyone is an amateur political commentator, and it's huge fun, and for that purpose to be encouraged, but it carries with it some dangers. At the same time that individual employees, private persons, are developing what I like to think of as a sort of public-private persona, a sort of made-up version of themselves for public consumption, employers are moving in the opposite direction. So if there's a party going on, they want to be there. If you work for a large corporation, the chances are, whilst you're tweeting about your life working for the corporation is tweeting about itself. Mm-hmm. It's like now having your boss attend every private party you go to.
Yes.
So there's a collision going on between what the employer's interests are and what the employee's interests in a private life are. And at the moment, we have no real way of sorting it out. And there are two potential approaches, both of which actually come up in the Smith case, which I know we're going to talk about later.
But well,
one is to say, well, what courts and tribunals are going to have to do now is look incredibly carefully at the individual facts of case and draw a kind of thin and rather tenuous line in each individual case between what is your public life and what is your private life, what your employer is entitled to know about and take into account when assessing your conduct, and what they're not. That presumes, of course, that it's just still possible to do that. And the alternative analysis is that it isn't anymore, that we have to cope with the fact that we now live in a world in which each individual employee has the power through publication to cause enormous harm to your business, to bring you, the employer, into disrepute, really as a result of typing no more than 140 characters and pressing return, and that we need new laws to deal with it.
Can you get round it by putting a disclaimer? I tweet in my own capacity, not in the capacity or representative of the company I work for.
Well, get around what? That's the problem.
Well,
you might as an employee think that a disclaimer is going to ensure there's absolutely no difficulty in terms of your relationship with your employer, but it doesn't seem to me to be that simple at all. A question arises again in the Smith case, again, which we will come to, the extent to which it is reasonable for people to feel that their employees' behaviours, even if disclaimed, are reflecting badly on them. And one can easily imagine circumstances in which, for instance, if you are working for the Terence Higgins Trust and your employees are pumping out into the world of social media endless homophobic nonsense, but at the end of each sentence say, you know, I disclaim all responsibility, this is not done on behalf of my employer, that's still nevertheless not a situation which an employer of that kind in that sector is likely to be able to tolerate for very long.
Mm.
So again, to come back to the point, you either say, well, we approach each of these cases on an individual and detailed analysis basis, or you say, well, the existing framework we have is not going to be enough, and that there isn't a kind of magic bullet answer in the form of a disclaimer which will help us.
Well, before we get on to the discrimination issues, I'm aware that a number of students have had difficulty with getting jobs because of some of the inappropriate remarks they've made or inappropriate pictures, which are fairly harmless in themselves, you know, showing them having fun at parties and perhaps behaving as students do.
Yeah.
We've all done it, I'm sure I did it. There was just no Facebook for me to reveal my idiocy to future employers. To what extent do you think employers should be entitled to take those into account in terms of an employment decision ex post facto? It might be that they look before and say, no, we're not going to interview those people, and no one ever knows what's gone on. But let's say you take someone on, then you find out, doing a due diligence after the event, which isn't always wise,
yes,
that someone has, in fact, perhaps done something stupid, not illegal, we're not talking about drugs or criminal offences here. How does tribunals and courts deal with that?
Well, for me, there is again a distinction to be drawn. So there are a wide variety of things I think employers ought not to be taking into account when reaching their decisions. And it seems to me that if you're going to run your business effectively, you should be focusing on issues, factors, past actions, which have some material impact on the ability of the employee actually to do their job.
Yeah.
So in an ideal world run by a dictator in my shape and form, you would as an employer simply have to focus on relevant considerations. And it seems to me that for the most part, what people did at university parties, etc., is unlikely to be any kind of relevant consideration for most employments. But the law, of course, isn't as intrusive. So it doesn't say to employers, here is a narrow range of things you're entitled to take into account when reaching employment decisions. It's at the opposite end of the spectrum. It says, here's a narrow range of things we preclude you from taking into account. So that's an expanding category. It starts with sex and race, but now it covers all the other protected characteristics with which we're familiar, including sexual orientation,
yes,
disability, etc. But I understand the policy of the law, which is so far as possible to leave to employers a discretion to take into account what they want to take into account, subject to properly protected categories being protected from unnecessary and unlawful, as a result of the legislation, discrimination. So society says, here are a limited range of things which we will forbid you from taking into account. Is there a case for expanding that? Well, I'm not sure how one would expand it in the circumstances you're describing, to say, well, you can't decide whether or not someone is good at their job on the basis of what their sexual characteristics are, makes sense to me. To say, well, we're going to have a rule which says you mustn't take into account what someone has done in their past is too vague to be applicable. As soon as you start to narrow it down to something which is going to have real utility in terms of allowing both employers and employees to know what their rights are in advance, then you end up folding into that question I identified earlier, which is facing the problem as to whether or not it simply is possible to have a rule which is anything other than it's all going to depend on the individual circumstances of the case. At that point, it seems to me to become useless in terms of a protected characteristic category. So just a recap, certainly needs one after being rambling on,
yeah,
with you. I can see that it is unfair that employers get to take that kind of material into account. On the other hand, it seems to me to be a good idea that the law limits its reach to certain easily identified, relatively easily defined and well accepted categories of protection.
Yes.
I have some doubts as whether we can force the problem into the existing.
Well, let me give you a very simple scenario. Company employs a young man, young woman.
Yes.
Takes them on, all the boxes are ticked, there's no misleading information on the curriculum vitae, the degrees are, qualifications are as stated, that's all been checked. But then they discover that the person's gay.
Yes.
Now that's a prohibited category, it's precluded, so they can't take that into account. And clearly, you know, the racial side doesn't come into to issue there, that would have been identifiable. But what happens if there's a revelation that a Class A drug has been taken? Because that might impact on the reputation of the company. It might also impact on the ability of that particular employee to do their job properly. How does the court deal with that situation?
Yes, well, it might be, and that's exactly what the court looks at.
Yeah.
So it says, you know, are you flying a plane? Are you the kind of person to whom this is going to have some relevance? And if the answer is yes, it does, then the likelihood is you're going to have a potentially fair reason for termination. So we're not, in those circumstances, talking about discrimination protection, but you might have a claim for unfair dismissal if you're sacked for something which is simply irrelevant to employment. And again, to take the impact on reputation into account, well, one has to ask logically whether it is likely to have any impact on reputation. And if you worked for a charity, the purpose of which was to wean people from drugs and to take a strong political stance which was opposed to drug legalisation and drug use, then the revelation that, say, a senior employee of yours was a regular user of a Class A drug will potentially have an impact.
Yeah, but there is a point of distinction there, and we know that very clearly, and others may do as well. One is a potentially fairly serious criminal offence,
yes,
Class A, and the other is alcohol consumption, which at the moment is not a criminal offence. It might be a social one, depending on misuse. So the subtle differentiation, pretty easier to get the dismissal proven fair for the drugs than the alcohol?
It might be.
Or is it not as simple as that?
It's not as simple as that,
no.
Because there's a substantial body of case law which deals with the question of the extent to which a non-work-related criminal conviction is the kind of thing which justifies an employer in terminating employment. And
yes,
even in those cases, it seems to me, one has to be satisfied that you're dealing with an offence which is sufficiently relevant or so overwhelmingly serious that it carries a relevance of its own that it would justify termination. So we don't, just because you have a driving conviction, you don't get sacked.
No.
The fact that you have, in the past, committed a serious physical offence will not necessarily mean that you lose your job. In each case, the tribunal will say, well, What was the relevance of this particular offence in these particular circumstances, and would it justify termination?
What was very interesting, many years ago when I was running BPPs, I had a young female student who was caught shoplifting. She stole a chicken.
I think
the value was £1.64. It seems to stick in my mind.
That would have been a while ago.
A while ago, yes. And unfortunately, although she was represented well in terms of the mitigation by a young barrister, she was suffering from stress and PMT and a number of other, you know, stressed conditions. And I obviously provided a good reference. She was given a conditional discharge, if I remember, and there was no fine. But the Bar Council refused to even consider her for as a fit and proper person to be called to the bar. And, you know, they did it with a heavy heart, and I did my best to represent, as did others, through CVs. Is that necessarily fair? Because she went on to apply to the Institute of Chartered Accountants, disclosed everything, and she was taken on. Two very different approaches being taken to criminality by two very well-known and respected professional organisations.
Well, I've had a similar experience. I say that it makes it sound as if I had a criminal conviction myself, which I stress I have not.
Which you haven't.
But when I was at bar school, we had someone literally hoiked out of a seminar we were attending, told that the Bar Council had discovered his undisclosed youthful criminal offence, and as a result, he was being kicked out of bar school because there was no discretion for him to continue. I mean, my own view, if I was setting the rules, would be I don't see why it has to be quite such a bright line rule. So I can see that people find themselves in circumstances where they end up with conviction, where there may be mitigation, which means that anyone who is fair-minded might think it wasn't the kind of thing which should deprive you of the career you've been working hard to develop. But I understand the policy will be that, you know, people at the bar simply have to be beyond question
in terms of their behaviour. Well, you'd have thought also a chartered accountant, of course.
Yes.
But it's a fair point. Let's turn to this fairly recent case, which surprised some, I suspect, of Smith and Trafford management. I mean, what's the story here, Sean?
You're dealing with a housing manager.
Yep.
Working for a private sector body, the Trafford Housing Trust. And he had a Facebook page. And it's a wonderful case because he has more or less the archetypal Facebook page. It declares him to be an employee of his employer. He has amongst his friends who are following him colleagues. But he also has the privacy settings set to what I understand is the default.
Yeah.
So not only can his friends see his messages, but his friends or friends can see the messages. So he has no real sense of who is going to be reading what he posts. And for the most part, what he posts about is football and motoring programs and food. But he is himself, as I understand it, a lay preacher. A lot of the makeup of his group of friends is people he's encountered in the course of his church work. And he decides to post something which he describes as provocative, by which he seems to have meant will cause people to have a discussion rather than will cause people's hair to stand on end.
Yes.
And it was about press coverage on the question as to whether or not people would be allowed to have civil partnership ceremonies in church. So he posts the link and he adds the comment, "An equality too far?" At which point one of his colleagues challenges him and says, "Well, do you not approve of the notion of having gay marriages in church?" And he thinks about it for a couple of days and then posts a message which says he doesn't, and he explains why, and what the judge ultimately finds to be, you know, it's kind of sensibly reasoned and polite and on the face of it inoffensive post, other than the fact that it's substantive content which expressed some implied disapproval of the notion of gay marriage was the kind of thing which might cause offence.
Mm.
So at that point, a colleague duly takes offence. He is reported, suspended, and disciplined. He would have been dismissed, it appears, but because of a long period of faithful service, he's demoted, and he loses 40% of his income. So he becomes a non-manager on a very substantial reduction in his pay. He appeals unsuccessfully, and it ends up in the court on the basis of a breach of contract action. So he says, "You didn't have a contractual entitlement to demote me. I want my old job back, and I want the money that you should have been paying me in the meantime." And it fell to Mr. Justice Briggs to decide whether or not the employer had a contractual entitlement to discipline him.
Yes.
So it raises these two hot button issues. Firstly, the extent to which your employer is entitled to go trampling around on your Facebook page, taking offence at things, or whether it's part of your private life. But also this very interesting interrelation between the protection afforded to different protected characteristics. So on the one hand, the law protects people on the grounds of their sexual orientation. On the other, it protects people's religious beliefs. And when those two protections came in simultaneously, originally in discrete sets of regulations, the question immediately arose, which is, well, how are you going to reconcile those two? And the reason why some reconciliation is necessary is it is utterly commonplace in the doctrines of the substantial religions of the world for there to be some real intolerance towards other people's sexual orientations. So one didn't need to be a genius to predict that there was going to be some kind of conflict between these two things, and the question was how it was going to be resolved. And there were really three possibilities, one of which would be to say, look, there's a conflict, and we're going to declare a winner. So you could say, and this seems to me to be the situation we're edging towards, but which the Smith case rather runs against, as we'll see, one could say, we will tolerate religious views and protect religious views up to a point. And the point at which this protection becomes partial is we will not tolerate intolerance. So insofar as your religious beliefs really impinge upon the protection of other protected characteristics, don't come to court or tribunal and expect us to protect that. So that would effectively declare a winner and say in a straight fight between the protections afforded to sexual orientation and protected to religious beliefs, we'll completely protect sexual orientation, but we'll partially protect religious beliefs. So the sexual orientation wins, effectively. Another approach is to say, right, there's a conflict, and what we'll do, UN style, is keep the combatants apart. So there was thought about at the time of the Liddell case, the prospect of a kind of reasonable accommodation duty, where you said, all right, we don't like the intolerant aspect of this particular religion, but what we'll do is effectively keep you away from anyone you might offend. So in the Liddell case, we will say, you don't approve of civil partnerships, that's fine, you go and register other relationships, we'll keep you, register our birth, deaths and marriages, away from civil partnerships. Or in the McFarlane and Relate case, they would say, okay, you don't believe in providing sexual counselling to same-sex partners, go and provide sex counselling to other partners and we'll have someone else deal with the same-sex relationships. So that notion of a sort of, as a peace wall, as it were, keeping the religious intolerance to one side without it being actively challenged, was run through in the Court of Appeal in the Liddell case, and they took a very clear view, which is we're not going to do that. So there's no reasonable accommodation of religious intolerance. The fight has to be had, or does it? Because then we get to the third possibility, excuse me, and the third possibility is to say, let's all close our eyes and pretend there isn't a conflict. Pretend that we're not having to choose to prioritise. And that's a large part is what the UK authorities have done. Mm. So they have tended to draw, to my mind, distinctions which are either, depending on your viewpoint, incredibly fine or else utterly spurious between holding a religious belief and acting on the basis of the religious belief. So they have said, in effect, by all means, hold the religious beliefs silently in your head and you know, we will protect your right to do that. But as soon as you start taking actions based upon them, then we will say, well, you've stepped outside the scope of protection. Which makes perfect sense to a lawyer. It just doesn't make any sense to anyone who's religious, because they say, well, if you take, for instance, Christianity, the notion that you should hold beliefs silently and let them in no way affect your actions is, you know, contrary to the entire notion how they feel they should be living their lives. And then even in the reasonable accommodation cases, you may be saying to employees, if you're talking to a Roman Catholic, for instance, who are under church discipline obligation to oppose same-sex relationships, formalise same-sex relationships wherever they have the opportunity, you might be saying, well, our equal opportunities demand it. And they're thinking, but the fate of my eternal soul is at risk here. Mm. You know, and you're asking me to weigh up my employer's equal opportunities and diversity policy and me suffering eternally. Yes. You know, I'd rather take the view that you should be giving more weight to the fate of my soul. So it makes sense to lawyers, it doesn't necessarily make sense to religious people, which is why I think it's recently cases have been so interesting, because we have this kind of this outrage expressed amongst Christian groups that why do we always lose our cases? The interesting thing about Smith is they didn't lose. There was a case in which a Christian won.
Yes.
So the judge comes to consider the case, and he says, well, you put wrongdoing in a number of different ways. You say, by posting comments on your Facebook page, you're representing our views. And the judge says, no, they're not. No one is going to look at his incredibly dull posts about Top Gear, you know, occasionally interspersed with comments about gay marriage, and think that he's representing the views of the trust. You know, and even the fact that there are on the page a reference to who his employer is, or he knows that some of his colleagues are reading it, that doesn't turn it into representing the trust, and no one reasonably would think that it did. Right, says the trust, we've got a specific provision which bans promotion of religious views, because we have to maintain publicly a neutrality between competing religious beliefs. And the judge says, well, this isn't promoting a religious view. he uses the rather vivid image of people thrusting their views on people. He says he's not thrusting his view on anyone. He has expressed in the most anodyne and mild form an opinion. He's been asked to expand upon it, which he has done, but you know, it's not like he has called everyone round to his house in order to preach at them. It's not as if he has sent an email to his colleagues demanding that they immediately surrender to the church. This is just an expression of a view. So he says it's not promotion. He envisages circumstances in which it might be, but he says it isn't. And he says even if it were, it would have to be within the context of the workplace or the work relationship, and this isn't enough. So this is where, for me, it gets very interesting. He says, right, I think you can draw a line between private life and your work life, and I'm going to do it here. And he takes a very thin pencil and starts saying, okay, well, let's look at this mess I'm faced with, a Facebook page which I know is looked at by colleagues, in which mention is made of his employer, but I still think I can draw a line between it and the kind of situation an employer has a legitimate right to be interested in.
Mm.
So there are work-related factors here, but they're not enough to outweigh his interest in a protected private life. So it's a judge who is saying, I still think it's a meaningful distinction. The world has not been changed completely by social media. I will draw the line and I can do it here. But it's a tenuous one, because quite a lot of what he's saying in the judgment is, bear in mind this is really a case about contract. I'm looking very carefully about how the clauses have been drafted. Had they been drafted differently, we might have different results and different aspects of the case. So it's not a bright line distinction. It's a specific line drawing for a specific set of circumstances.
How broad a precedent would it be? Because you've made a point that I think is important. It is a contract case, essentially. Is it likely to be indicative of thinking in the general employment context for unfair dismissal?
I think it's unlikely to, except, weirdly, the last point. The last form of misconduct which the employer argued was that this was bringing them into disrepute.
Yeah.
And they take the traditional employer arguments, which is that you're damaging our mission. You know, unless everyone is singing from the same hymn sheet, a very unfortunate image given the religious discrimination background, but, you know, on message, to adopt the political equivalent, you risk frustrating and sabotaging what we're trying to achieve. And in particular, what is said is, look, you are outraging your colleagues. You are upsetting them. And indeed, they were all interviewed, and some said they thought it was blatant homophobia, and someone else said it was annoying, and others said it was pathetic. But there was a kind of range of reaction to it. But was he harming the interests of his fellow employees? Well, what the judge says, and this might, it seems to me, be something we're going to get to hear a lot of in the tribunal, is, you might well be offended by the expression of this opinion, but in essence, tough. He says, you know, it's not phrased particularly aggressively.
Yes.
It's a calm and reasoned formulation. And he says, well, in those circumstances, it's part of the price of freedom of expression that you have to live with the fact that if you have strongly opposed views, you're going to get a bit upset. So if we try and create a world in which there is freedom of expression, but you must never upset anyone, he accepts you're never going to have real freedom of expression. Now, that does seem to me to be significant, because quite a lot of the cases I see in tribunal, both as an advocate and as an occasional fee-paid employment judge, really turn on that argument, this notion that, you know, if people are offended, then you shouldn't be saying it at all. And that an employer has a right to restrict your freedom of expression to protect his own interests and the sensibilities of colleagues.
Well, a lot of people on using social media, of course, are getting impatient with the law. It's not just the government who want to cherry-pick bits of law that they're going to observe. And we've got the chilling effect of the contempt of court laws. We've got the chilling effect of libel actions. We've got the potential chilling effect of employment law. How safe is it to use social media these days?
Well, it's less safe than people think it is. Mm. Right back at the start, I said there were kind of two points. We've looked at the broader social one. The narrower one is, really, how different is this?
Yes.
Do our existing employment laws cope? And I've said there's a difficulty in drawing lines. That's hard. But if you look at social media broadly speaking, one might say, has it ever been the case that you have been able, through communication, to damage your employer's interests? Has it ever been the case that that might amount to misconduct? And if it does, might dismissal justly follow? And the answer is yes, yes, and yes. So you have always been able to write something inappropriate in a newspaper or shout something inappropriate at a client or customer, find yourself in trouble and get sacked. What is spinning people's heads at the moment is really two things. One thing shouldn't be a problem, and that's that the courts and tribunals are just a bit bemused about what social media is. So you get sort of entertaining descriptions of what Facebook is and how it works for people who've obviously never used it.
Yeah, it's great.
And that creates a certain amount of fear. So in the tribunal at the moment, we're going through the same thing we went through when email first became prominent, which is that there's a kind of techno fear, and that is dealt with rather than applying the ordinary principles of what has this person done, what damage did it cause or risk, and does that justify dismissal? They're hiding behind policies. So they say, do you have a social media policy? And does it cover this? And if it does cover it, it's probably a fair dismissal. And if you don't have a policy, or if you failed adequately to communicate it, then the chances are it's going to be an unfair dismissal. So the tribunals, rather than taking the issue head on, suffering from a bit of fear of technology and the way the world is changing faster than they can keep up with, so they default to the question of whether or not you have adequately legislated within your business for it. That'll last about 2 years. That's what happened with emails. And then they will get bolder and more prepared to look directly at the issues. So that gets us to the second and real difference, which is it used to be quite difficult to damage your employer by what you said, because it was very difficult to get together an audience large enough to really move the needle on your employer's reputation. That has all changed.
Yes.
So, you know, one tweet, retweeted and retweeted and retweeted, can reach an enormous audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can, in a way that the employer has no control over, create real damage in no time flat. Now, from an employment lawyer's point of view, dealing with the consequences are relatively straightforward, because you just say, right, what did you do? What was the consequence? Was it bad enough? Does it justify termination? The real difficulty, therefore, is not for how you fit it into existing concepts of misconduct, but how the heck, as an employer, you stop it happening in the first place. And that's where it gets fascinating for me, because I sat down to draft what's going to be a kind of open source social media policy, and I found that rapidly I turned into Joseph Stalin. You know, in order to see off every potential existential risk, you had to be so prescriptive that it really made the use of social media effectively impossible.
Let me ask you a question, Sean, and as a contract lawyer myself, not an employment specialist, but surely any new social media policy would only apply to new employees unless there had been a fresh consideration for old employees. What's the situation there?
Well, yes, but...
Ish.
generally speaking, in employment law, we magic consideration out of nothing. So
yes.
We tend to say that, for instance, the consideration for your agreement to our new policy is our forbearance in not terminating your employment and going to find someone else. Or, you know, your consideration for the pay rise that we have awarded you is you're not asking for an even bigger pay rise. So it's a rare case, in fact I can't think of one off the top of my head, in which an employment tribunal or a court considering an employment case.
But it would be a good idea, surely. It would be a good idea, surely, to put any new policies before old employees. A good business practice.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it would be essential. And the truth is that most employers now have a kind of two-stage approach to governing their employees' behaviour. So there will be a very short form contract, and in it there will be a clause which says you're bound by the contract and such policies as we may have enforced from time to time and introduce. So the consideration issue becomes academic because they've agreed in advance to them being changed.
Yes.
But where employers fall down is, particularly at this early stage where everything turns on the policy, is they fail to show that they've communicated it adequately.
Yeah.
So I had an extraordinary case about someone who had, again, an early email case. He worked as a chef for a bank, and he had distributed pornography so extreme that, for the most part, we just didn't understand what was happening in the pictures that he had distributed, including one extraordinary picture which involved a woman, a gas mask, and an aubergine, which detained the tribunal for 15 minutes as they sought to work out where the obscenity lay and in what particular part of the male mind it was exciting. But he took the position that we hadn't sufficiently circulated the email policy, in that although it had arrived in his email box, he hadn't been asked specifically to read it and he hadn't signed it. And we took what we thought was the common sense position, at, that if he'd asked himself for a second, would human resources approve of me circulating this kind of material within the workplace using my official bank email, he would have known that the answer was no. But the tribunal took the view that no proof that the policy had been thrust in front of him and signed meant that they couldn't rely on it.
Yeah, so there are dangers. And it's only likely that these that larger companies are going to have sophisticated contracts where drafts are prepared by men and women specialists like you to protect the company. But the average employee was perhaps five or six employees. Employer with five or six employees can have no real legal protection at all.
No, certainly not at this stage. No. It's unlikely they're going to have the suite of policies that they need.
Quite.
And again, interesting point about Smith is that they did have a suite of policies in place, including one which covered out-of-work activities, including specifically Facebook use, and it got closely interpreted out of application. So even if you are a big employer, you may well find that your policies looked at askance and very carefully interpreted.
It's a fascinating case. I mean, I'm not a specialist in employment, but I read the case with considerable interest at the weekend, preparing for today. Sean, can we turn away from the specifics of law and
of course.
To the wider issue of professional practice? You've been in practice for many years at 11KBW. And what changes have you seen, in broad terms, over the last 20 or so years?
At the bar, surprisingly little. I say surprisingly little because when I joined the bar, the sky was falling. So there were crisis meetings at which we were told that the bar was about to go out of existence, and Herbert Smith, as they then were, had declared themselves the enemy of the bar, and they were going to bring all barristers in-house at one firm or another and end the existence of the independent bar. And I sat opposite a Lord Justice of Appeal who was addressing potential barristers and asked them why anyone in their right mind would now come to the bar. And he said, well, I don't know. It may just be that kind of person, I suppose. I now see, actually, on reflection, that there is some truth in that. I mean, the bar has survived partly because it's composed of people who don't really play well with others. Mm. If you can imagine, there's a kind of just a little taint of, I hesitate to say mental illness, but a particular form of personality with people who absolutely can't let anyone else get the last word.
Yes.
You know, find it terribly difficult to sit behind other people as points are being made. And that makes us, it means we have to work hard to be team players.
Yeah.
And there's a social benefit, I think, in kind of fencing us off. But my day-to-day practice is pretty much as it was back in 1991. There are a fresh group of threats on the horizon. Mm. And one particularly interesting one from the point of view of employment barristers, which is this, that we used to be a model. I say that immodestly. A lot of my friends and colleagues, and indeed my wife, are legal aid lawyers.
Yeah.
And you can't have been involved in the law, even peripherally, without spotting what's happened to legal aid over the course of the past 20 years. I mean, there's effectively been at no point any kind of increase in remuneration, but several cuts. So what was said is, well, look, this is tremendous danger to the bar. Unless there is an ongoing source of well-paid, remunerative, publicly funded work, what will the bar do? And at the employment bar, we used to say rather smugly, well, look, we practice principally in the employment tribunal. There are no exclusive rights of audience. Anyone can, and pretty frequently anyone does, turn up to represent parties. And yet the employment bar is growing by leaps and bounds. And what that means is, absent any source of public funding, absent any exclusive rights of audience, we can convince people that we do a job which is a sufficient value that it is worth instructing a barrister to present your case.
Mm.
So we would say, look, you know, we're focused on the true virtues of the bar, skill at advocacy, skill and advice, independence, the opportunity to come from anywhere, any firm in the country, and instruct the very best people who were available to do your case. So smug we were. But what we hadn't counted on, of course, is the fact that as it became harder and harder to make a living doing publicly funded work, everyone decided that they were now an employment lawyer. So we had handed out this brochure about how lovely life on the employment law beach was, and now everyone has come to join us. So I can't think of a set on King's Bench Walk that doesn't offer itself as having some kind of employment law expertise.
Yeah. Are you trying to lift up the drawbridge?
it's way too late and wouldn't be fair in any event. But it has created a bit of a rush to the bottom. So what we've been, in terms of fees, so what we've been experiencing recently in the employment bar is tremendous fee pressure.
Mm.
And if anything is going to threaten the ongoing existence of the bar, it will be a wider spread of the existing experience of legal aid lawyers, which is to be publicly undervalued in the job they do and financially underpaid, so they simply can't support themselves in an independent
practice. Well, a lot of criminal lawyers, for example, and some family lawyers are moving out of the field into others, and I would have thought employment law must be an attractive proposition for them.
It is. Well, of course, I, as former member of the Employment Law Bar Association Committee, I welcome all comers to the practice of employment law, but there sure are a lot of us now, and what that is telling you is that there are unsustained financial pressures in other parts of the country.
Well, competition has always been very much part of the landscape of the bar, the life of the bar. I mean, not much has changed there, and I mean, I've had to tell students in the past, well, the practical realities are that pupillage ratio to tenancy is probably 6-1.
Yes.
Still probably of a similar order. But the bar has always attracted independent spirited people. If you've got the intellectual apparatus and you've got a 2-1 or a first, then you've certainly got the makings of a career at the bar. Now you've got to take the risk. And risks there are.
It's
initially.
A huge risk, don't you think? I mean, I know you're at BPP,
so
I hesitate to criticise the legal education sector, but
why are we training
so many potential barristers?
Well, we weren't in those days quite to the number that we're doing now. I'm not connected in any way with BPP or the College of Law. I know the deans of both well, and I've in fact been fairly critical of the stance that both colleges are taking and taking on too many people. But the trouble is, they counter the argument by saying that everyone has a right to a career, and provided they're aware of the risks, who are we to stop them?
I know that there's this kind of X factor mentality now. So
yes,
if I do, let's say, an open day, let's say there's a pupillage fair, people come to see you and they will say, I very much want to be a barrister. And you say, that's interesting. I say, well, don't really like public speaking much. You know, my degree results don't add up to very much. And you think, why have you chosen this?
Yes,
it's not that, you know, I'm anxious to keep people away from the bar, but you think, well, how are you going to make this work?
You've got to be realistic. I mean, you've got to have realistic expectations. You've got to have the intellectual capability. You've got to have a drive and enthusiasm to do it. And you certainly, if you're going to be an advocate, you've got to be fairly comfortable, not just comfortable with, but rather good at public speaking, because otherwise you're just not fit for the purpose.
But we sort of believe socially now, and I think this is as a result of television. I sound so old and so incredibly right-wing saying this kind of thing, but there is a belief that if you have passion and you have a dream, then you will, of course, you will succeed. And even if you don't, then you at least you will have lived a great life trying. The truth is that people come out of university now with crippling debt.
Mm.
And to train at the bar means more debt. And the bar is cruel in the sense that rather than having a bright line end, saying, well, good try, that's the end of it, if you can find somewhere to squat, you can keep making just enough money to service your debts and keep going without ever really making a success of it until you're effectively ground out. And the statistics that people tend to ignore is once they've swallowed, the extraordinarily unlikelihood that they're actually going to be able to obtain pupillage, and then from there tenancy, they ignore the fact that there's a massive fall off in the first 10 years of practice. And it's not through people failing or being not up to it. These are all people who've proven that they have the goods.
Yeah.
But it's just that the way that the market works is a cruel one. And the way you exit it is by reaching a point at which you simply can no longer afford to be doing what you're doing. And that's a big risk. I mean, there are all sorts of other life risks we don't let people take merely because they profess to have a passion and a dream. And I think if we have this many people applying in circumstances where they simply have no realistic prospect of being taken on, then we are not doing enough to
get
how hard it is.
You know, students particularly, and I'm very keen to get this message across, you've got to look at it with a very cold, hard eye.
Yes.
And you've got to take the advice of people at the top of the profession, and if they're saying, think hard and long, and it is a very cruel world, there's no real safety net, then take that into account.
Yes.
If, having taken everything into account, you are hell-bent on a career, then so be it. Because the bar itself, the bar council itself, ran into problems in terms of trying to restrict the numbers, because they were threatened with a reference to the competition authorities. So there were difficulties there, which perhaps wasn't a terribly helpful intervention of competition law, because it may be that the only people who can control the law schools are effectively the Bar Council and the Bar Standards Board in terms of the bar and the solicitors and Law Society and Solicitors Regulation Authority. And indeed, to be fair, BPP ran into problems a few years ago by taking on too many students, and rightly, they got, I was pretty critical in my blog, and rightly, they got their knuckles wrapped for that misdemeanor. But it's absolutely fascinating. Are you reasonably optimistic about the immediate to medium-term future?
Yes, I can't see what's wrong with the bar. That's my fundamental problem. I can see that there are other ways of organising ourselves. But I like the idea, it seems to me to be a good idea, that you can have a problem with your employer, you can walk into a high street firm in Walton on Naas, you can say, this case involves all sorts of completely novel, complex points about employment law. You have a solicitor who may have a passing understanding of employment law, but they can get out a directory and find someone who really, really knows their stuff, who is available to them. So if you take someone like Chris Jeans and Chambers, he's my employment law hero. And if I ever need an employment lawyer, I would certainly go to Christopher Jeans. But anyone can instruct Christopher Jeans.
Yes.
If we restructure the profession in the ways presently proposed, all sorts of complications arise. So let's say the employer in that case has instructed me. If we are forced into or persuaded into partnerships or quasi-partnerships, immediately Chris Jeans is unavailable because there's a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
So it's reduced the availability of expertise to the market. Or let's say he goes into an ABS relationship and we're part owned by a firm of solicitors and part owned by private equity. Again, there are going to be conflict of interest issues, but you may simply vanish. I mean, when Herbert Smith set up its in-house team, it acquired some genuine talent, some very senior, excellent advocates. And those people thereafter were available to Herbert Smith's clients and to no one else.
Yes.
So the truth is that if the market set about recruiting into firms of solicitors or combined firms or any of the broad variety of different proposed structures, the best of the bar, they're sequestrating them away from access by ordinary individuals.
Well, as independent practitioners at the bar, which you are, you face a potential threat from the post-LSA world in the commoditization of legal advice.
Yes.
And, I mean, only the other day we had the government saying we're going to cut back on the amount of face time that you get with a doctor, and you can go on to NHS direct. And I've been on there, and it's like a complicated computer algorithm. Have you got this? No. But I've got this. Yes, I've got that. In which case, you know, you're going to be okay. Or you've got to go see a doctor. Now, you know, the basics of employment law are fairly structured and fairly straightforward. You could have almost a sophisticated algorithm to answer most legal questions. This is a post-dystopic world coming where, you know, human intervention isn't necessary.
Well, it ignores something. And what it ignores is that over the door of every set of barristers' chambers should be the words, just because you're right doesn't mean you're going to win. So I think what is often ignored by the market and is ignored by about 80% of the potential pupils I come across is that our job isn't about arguing and being right. It's a persuasion job. So it's effectively sales that we do.
Mm.
So if you are appearing in front of some irascible employment judge, your job is not simply to be correct, but to persuade them that you are correct and indeed a further stage, which is not only persuade them that you're correct, but persuade them that they shouldn't try and find some clever way around your correctness to a defensible incorrect position, which you have, if you have a suitably unpleasant client, they might well be inclined to do. So the notion that even if it were true, which it plainly isn't, that the law is so clear that in any given set of circumstances, 10 minutes of research on the internet will give you the correct answer. Even if employment law wasn't all reasonableness and involving a lot of it, judgment applied to individual sets of circumstances, even in that situation, it's not enough. You still need people to turn up to a court or tribunal and work the magic of persuasion. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be a barrister, but it has to be someone who's good at a particular job. And there's no amount of being sat in your room typing away at the internet which is going to confer that gift on you if you don't have it.
John, we're coming up to the 50-minute mark, and we've covered some pretty complex issues, hopefully in a way that everyone can relate to. I think so. I'd like to thank you very much indeed for a stimulating discussion. I'm sure we could go on for at least another half hour. But we've at least touched on some of the key issues, so my thanks.
Well, may I gladden my mother's heart by saying thank you for having me.